Hello everyone and welcome to another Scanline Status for August 18th, 2016. I am Colin Detmar, and I'm joined, as always, by Ben Uncle.
Hi.
And we're here to talk about the world of video games and a little bit outside of it sometimes.
Yeah, mostly video games this week, I think.
Yeah, today we got a pretty good lineup. And I guess we should probably start with what, you know, everyone's talking about lately, which is No Man's Sky.
Yeah, so I ended up pre-ordering the PC version, which, as it turns out, I got kind of lucky with, because the PC version launched in a pretty broken state for a decent amount of folk, and I was lucky enough that my only technical issue was the really terrible frame rate for the first 20 or 30 minutes, and then it starts working fine.
Hmm. Have you been having, like, there have been some things that I've been hearing kind of, I feel like almost universally, like, have you been getting the dithering draw-in as you land on a planet, for instance?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's,
That's just system level.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's possible that I haven't turned everything up, because even with a fairly good PC, it's one of those situations where it's a brand new game, kind of pushing all sorts of weird boundaries, so maybe running everything on max, especially with the aforementioned frame rate issues, isn't the best idea right now, but
yeah, it seems like it must be pretty CPU intensive from what they're trying to do.
Oh, for sure. But also, the whole frame rate thing was an issue of the graphics card having to get used to the information, essentially, or something like that. I don't know much about technology, so.
Well, and also, like, I mean, it's a 10-person team. It's probably not the most optimized thing in the world.
Yeah, that too. Like, I feel kind of bad for them, because basically, as soon as the PC version hit, right before it, they were pulling an all-nighter to get it out, and then right after, they were pulling another all-nighter just to fix some of the biggest issues that had arisen during the launch.
And as might be expected, sadly, people were being pretty angry and kind of dickheaded about the performance of the various versions of the game, right?
Yeah. Even more than that, it's people are being really, really accusatory over things that they've said in the past, and things that they've kind of shown in the past, and things that didn't make it to the final cut, in a way that's, it seems really, really overblown compared to what's actually, the accusations seem way more overblown than how it actually came out, but I guess when something is this anticipated and this much of a massive release, that's going to happen even to the smallest of teams.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, to be fair, it's not unique to them. There is a lot of this around, you know, a lot of big releases of like, hey, you promised this and you didn't deliver it, you know? But also, like, and you know, there's never any excuse for the level to which some people are willing to take this, right? Like, mm-hmm. Cursing and threats and stuff, there's never any excuse for that, but they did ship a game on PC that, like, not early access. This game is not an early access, it's just a release, and it didn't work, and they've gotten it working better, but, like, I don't know, like, I don't care who you are, when you put out a game and you say it's done and it doesn't work, that's not okay.
I feel like this has happened with other big releases in the past, though, and it didn't get nearly this level of backlash.
Oh, sure, sure. I can't, like, I'm not making excuses for the community, because the community always takes it to a psychotic degree for anything. But for my part, you know, if I'd bought this on PC and it hadn't worked, I would have been pissed. And I would have been pissed for any other game where that happened, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I had a few friends who were angrily, or closer, jealously, kind of messaging me on Steam while I was playing, because they were like, how the hell did you get this to work? And I was like, I just turned it on and it worked, which made them even angrier.
I don't know. And I guess the other sort of thread around the game is expectations, which a bunch of people decided the game was going to be more than they ever said it was going to be. For my part, it seems like the game is basically what I thought it would be. How are you finding it as a person who has played it and is not a person just making conjecture based on videos he's seen?
So, I kind of... My whole trajectory with that series was... I was watching the VGX when it was announced, like most other people. I was... As someone who has played their previous games, which is pretty much Geodanger, Geodanger 2, and Geodanger Mobile, I was kind of really happy for them because it was like, oh man, you're going from this really small sort of niche but fun platforming thing to this unbelievable massive scale thing. And as time went over, I kind of forgot about it a bit and kind of heard from you maybe that it was pretty much a crafting game, and I was like, oh, survival crafting's not really my sort of thing. But as it got close, on the week of the launch, I was hearing from people who got it on PS4 that the survival elements really weren't that bad. And that was enough to make me go, yeah, I kind of want to see this. I want to see what this is like. And playing it, it's one of those situations where it's really, really relaxing in a way. Even though the mechanics themselves of mining, of trading, all that stuff loses its surprise and discovery. Even discovering certain new buildings, they kind of repeat almost. I'm on my maybe sixth or seventh planet in my third or fourth galaxy. Third or fourth star system. That's the right word. And
yeah,
there's a lot of repeating stuff already, but the worlds themselves are still very unique, and I find that the dull nature of the A to B sort of mechanics really make the moments where you find things like a dilapidated castle part that you've never seen before really magical in a way.
Hmm. So, I'm trying to think of what questions I have about. Like, I was talking to someone else about this game. I don't know, maybe I was talking to you, I don't know. To me, it seems kind of like a tech demo, and usually, like, when I talk about games as being tech demos, usually you're talking about something like, oh, they're crowd tech, or they're, like, you know, animation tech, or just their graphics, right? Or their physics. And this seems like, asset generation tech demo to me, which is a way bigger deal. I'm not trying to be condescending when I say tech demo, but, like, I think you understand what I'm trying to say, and does that feel true to you?
Yeah, you're basically saying that the advances that it's made to technology is something that you've never really seen anywhere else, and that's kind of its big hook. Like, sort of like a Hitman Blood Money had that level in New Orleans where it just had an immense amount of crowd coming through, but that was just kind of the hook, and it wasn't really, you couldn't really do much with the crowd, or in game sense, the Red Faction series, which has pretty much always been, hey, check it out, we can blow things up really well, and it will stick.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's one of those situations where I kind of see, I don't really feel the novelty of hitting a new planet every time. It's more of just the way that every once in a while I'll stumble onto a planet I really adore. Like, something about the way that it's constructed just really speaks to me. Like, this one planet I went to that was dotted with small landmasses around this gigantic, encompassing body of water, and also this cute little snow level that was filled with all sorts of neat little creatures that I look at screenshots and I've never seen. They somehow make all these different creatures look really good, and you never see the same creatures in other people's screenshots, which is actually a bit more impressive to me than the whole quintillion planets thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, those numbers are never, like, you know, what, like, Borderlands 2 had, like, 700 billion guns or something? Like, those numbers are just nonsense at some point.
Yeah.
And they, you know, like, Borderlands was counting every different version of the same gun model with slightly different numbers on it. So, like, also those numbers don't represent very much. It's what you see that counts.
Yeah, and planets more or less are a lot of what you see, so I feel like it's a bit more powerful than the whole gun thing. And also, anything about planets with Borderland guns, it's one of those things where you find a terrible gun and it's just like, oh, I'm not going to even equip this. But when you find a terrible planet, sometimes it can be rewarding on its own right. Like, oh, this place is really fire and brimstone, and it has a constant solar radiation wind, so everything is dropping really quickly. This is a really terrible place to live. I'm getting out of here immediately. And then you find some, after a few more planets, you find something that's just very pleasant, and you find things that seem to survive in otherwise harsh environments, and you run into shelter when storms are coming through. And it's one of those situations where people always talk about the player creating their own story. And No Man's Sky has just little enough story to it, and just enough sort of mechanics that are, you don't really even think about, they just become natural, like breathing or going to the bathroom, that it really lays the groundwork for you to have this amazing adventure, more or less. Or, amazing might be too strong a word, a very chill adventure.
So, okay. Let's talk about games that have been kind of like proof of their ideas, right? And let's figure out where this one falls on the scale, as it were. Like, you've got games like Assassin's Creed 1, obviously. You've got games like Shadow of Mordor, which was, like, I think more developed as a game, but was basically a proof of concept for the Nemesis system. You've got a game like Portal, which is a pretty, like, it is a proof of the Portal concept and also a pretty thorough execution of it. Like, where on that kind of continuity do you think No Man's Sky falls with its exploration of this new idea of procedural? I mean, not procedural. It's the way it does creation is different than other games have done creation in the past. Where do you think it falls on that sort of?
Well, I definitely put it above Shadow of Mordor because I kind of really dislike Shadow of Mordor. I think that,
well, like, let's not, like, maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but, like, not like, how well do you review it? Like, how much of an exploration, how much of a thorough and thoughtful exploration of that concept do you think it is? Because, like, Shadow of Mordor, like it or not, was a pretty fully fledged game with that concept.
I guess you're right. I guess I would put it right a few notches below Portal, essentially, which I think is at the very top, followed by Shadow of Mordor, and what was the other one?
I mean, you can use other examples if you can think of them. Off the top of my head, I came up with Shadow of Mordor, Portal, and Assassin's Creed 1.
Oh. Yeah, it's hard to say exactly. It's hard to think of them off the top of my head because most of the time when these sorts of things come out, you kind of think back to them when someone creates an article about, oh, this is where this thing got its inspiration from. So they're kind of easily forgotten.
Unless, okay, well, let me try and come up with some more, then.
Okay.
Red Faction 1, with its geomod technology.
I guess Split Second would be one of those kinds, because its whole thing was, hey, check out how we can destroy parts of the track over time.
I'm going to say the first Tony Hawk.
Ooh, that's a good one. I guess I'd put Portal and Tony Hawk at the top of their sort of execution, because those were just, even if you discard the whole novelty of what they brought in. Those are just amazing games that you can come back to and still be like, yeah, this is pretty great. Even though Tony Hawk didn't have the manuals and reverts and stuff like that that they had later. And, I guess when you put it that way, it's a lot closer to Red Faction, but I feel like it gets a lot more mileage out of what it does than Red Faction did.
Yeah, I think what it's like, that's, for me, that's what I felt from the outside, and I didn't want people to think I was being mean, because I think, like, it's a game with one trick, and if you take that trick away, there's not a lot to it that's impressive. But that's kind of a stupid statement, because that one trick is so magical.
Yeah, it's really fun to basically jet from one planet to the next and maybe just spend five minutes is the right number for flying from one half of a planet to another. A bit of above that, it becomes kind of boring, but it's just something that's really pleasant to sort of be like, to poke around and see what's new, even if sometimes the things that you find that are new aren't as new as you would have hoped for.
Well, all right. I'm going to move on to a game that I have played. I will touch very briefly and say I have picked up Professor Layton and the Unwound Future. I am playing it. Once I have beaten it, I will have more thoughts. Right now, it is Professor Layton.
Nice.
And I like it. I am enjoying it. But right now, it's Professor Layton.
Yeah, I ended up ordering Diabolical Box again after you talked about it. And I've been playing a bit of that on and off. And I've been, after you kind of suggested that sometimes you just need to
just look up answers.
Yeah,
just like,
pretty much.
If you look at a puzzle and you say, this doesn't look fun to think through, just look up the answer. You'll have such a better time.
Yeah, and sometimes the answers themselves are just slight permutations of what you were already thinking, which is always really annoying. It's like, I already answered that. That was what I was guessing the first time. But yeah, it's a lot more fun when you just go, okay, this level, nah, I'm gonna quickly Google Layton puzzle 39 and get it done.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a better time. But the game I did bring, one of the games I brought today, was a PS2 classic that I've been playing. So I now live downstairs from my nephews, right? And anyone with kids can tell you, you can tell kids where they're allowed to go. They do not care. So they come downstairs a lot. And sometimes it's like, well, I would like to do something that is not just watching them and making sure they don't break things. So sometimes it's like, well, hey, can I play a game that they will find entertaining to watch and is also appropriate? Like, my 3-year-old nephew thinks Overwatch is really cool, but you're shooting a lot of people in that game, so I try not to play it around him. But what I did decide to play around them, and they are enchanted by, is Ape Escape 2, which I have never played before.
How'd you come across it, then?
It is on the PS4.
Nice.
It is one of the PS2 classics, and Alex Navarro actually mentioned it on one of the recent Beastcasts, and I was like, huh. I remember watching a speedrun of that on SGDQ this year, and it did not... It looked interesting, it looked weird, because it's an SGDQ run of an older game where they've broken it pretty thoroughly, but it was like, huh, that looks interesting. And, yeah, that game's just simple fun. You know, it's a 3D platformer where you're running around and trying to catch monkeys, and, you know, it's very cartoony. I need to look up who made the game, because it was released, like, when you boot up the game, it says Sony Computer Entertainment Europe, right?
Yeah.
And all the voice acting is very clearly British voice actors, right? But all the art style and a lot of the cultural references are clearly anime. Like, one of the characters, your support, is clearly just Misty from Pokemon, basically. And it makes me curious if, like, it's like, oh no, this is just, yeah, okay. It is originally developed by Sony Computer Entertainment Japan Studio. that makes more sense. I kind of wish that wasn't the case, because it would have been really magical if this game was like them saying, well, Japan's hot right now, let's copy Japan, you know? Because the lady with the London accent talking to you and telling you your mission directives, and, you know, like, there's a lot of really... It's kind of weird playing games that were localized for England or the United Kingdom or whatever we want to... I don't know. I am bad at this terminology, right? But
yeah.
for Britain. Because it is like, you know, they speak English and they use the same words, but sometimes they don't, and the accents are a little bit different, and it's just... It's kind of weird sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Looking at the page, it was distributed by Ubisoft in America, so I guess that might be part of the weird localization.
I think that's not the version that's on the PS4. There's no Ubisoft logo anywhere on the PS4 version. So maybe that's it. Like in the Japanese version, or in the English version, like, the characters are named like Jimmy and Natalie and Spike, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are not the names in this game. They're Natsumi and Hikaru, but, you know, with a British accent. So I wonder if, because it was Ubisoft that released it in the United States, maybe Sony Computer Entertainment Europe released it in Europe, and that was therefore the version that they could license.
That makes sense.
I'm glad I don't know the English version, because I find the Britishness of it kind of magical. It's like a game made by Japan, localized for England, played by an American. I got the same thing when I was playing Xenoblade Chronicles on the Wii, because that's a British localization, and you have this, you know, you have this guy with anybody in Europe, I'm sorry that I'm going to name the locations of these accents wrong, because I do not know the subregions of England very well. But like a Southside London thug guy going, no, it's Rhine time, and you're like, this is great. It's this fucking anime boy with his like his big, you know, like battle axe, with this like, you know, British college student voice, and it's the greatest. I love it. It's such a weird like cultural combination.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun than some of the weirder modern localization stuff where it's like, oh yeah, all these different nationalities, they're all pretty American with their accents.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure, like, I guess, like, I don't know, I assume if you are British yourself, then it's just like when we play a game where everyone's American, but I feel like maybe the approach to localization is different. It's hard to say, but my nephews are loving watching this game. It's pretty fun. There is a whole lot of it. And yeah, the Britishness of it is very charming.
So, was it that first one or the second one that kind of... We were talking earlier about games that exemplify technology. I know that something about the DualShock kind of launched with one of the Ape Escapes, so...
That was Ape Escape 1. Yeah, Ape Escape 1 was with the launch of the DualShock controller on the PlayStation 1. Ape Escape 2 is a PS2 game.
Ah, so. Makes sense.
And there is apparently an Ape Escape 3, which I didn't know, and I guess means that was not super well respected or something? I don't know.
Yeah, and then Ape Escape 4 is the minigame from Metal Gear Solid 3 Subsistence.
What a bummer. That's a sad way for that franchise to go out.
For sure.
Well.
Sorry for ending your happy anecdote on a downer.
Well, hey, the character from the first game made it into PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royal, and that was also a downer note. Well, what else have you been playing?
Okay, so I've kind of been getting more into that... Mr. Robot game that was kind of teased before on that teaser I briefly mentioned an episode or two ago. Turns out that it was very much what it was advertising. It's a mobile app that basically it's kind of acts like Lifeline, more or less, except it has a lot more to it, because Lifeline, it was very much, you open this one interface and you answer questions once in a while, and that's the whole thing.
I want to briefly interrupt and note that we are talking about the iOS game Lifeline and not the PS2 voice chat game Lifeline, where you guided a woman around a facility and she had a gun.
Good point. And that PS2 Lifeline was notably terrible.
It wasn't notably, though. That's the thing, is like, I issued that clarification kind of because I'm a jackass and wanted props for knowing that, because nobody remembers that game.
But yeah, this Mr. Robot game, which full title is Mr. Robot 1.51 exfiltration.ipa, which has weird font and numbers substituted for letters in some places. And basically, the gist of it is you're wandering around this area, you happen to pass by the F Society base because it's basically hidden. There's a phone on the ground. You decide, hey, it'd be a good idea to take it and wipe the SD card and just use it for myself. So you're basically navigating this fake phone interface, and then eventually you start seeing, even though you wiped it, you start seeing messages that were meant for her, the owner, and not too soon. I know too long after that, she starts messaging you, and she's pretty angry. And from there, you're basically forced into this position where you need to help her out, or else she'll make your life a living hell. And it kind of goes from, okay, I need you to try and get this file, to, there are these people that actually think you're me, so I need you to pretend that you are me, and that you can get certain things done that wouldn't be expected from a regular Joe most of the time.
Hmm. Do you feel like... how much of your appreciation of this game do you think is based on its connection to the show, and how much is based on... I don't want to say its own merit, because that sounds harsh, but, you know, I guess that.
I think it's a little bit of both. Like, I think that the way that they kind of tie into what's happening around this time in the show and let you know what time it is around the show is pretty clever. You get a few news bulletins. You hear some mentions about having to get this information from someone who works at Steel Mountain, which is this gigantic server database that they're trying to break into. But there's also this element of, it's touching on some really interesting modern cultural touchstones the way that the show does. Like, at some point you end up being knocked into this group text message that isn't either related to yourself or this person's connections that used to own the phone. And it's just this weird thing of, hey, I'm not really this person, but they keep going, oh no, you're such a joker, and they're basically talking about their vacation plans, the different things that they do, and you kind of start getting into this voyeuristic sort of thing where you pretend to be a member of the gang, more or less. And you get all sorts of weird messages, like people doing just really dumb, jackassy things that friends do in real life, like people posting about what kind of presents they're going to get each other, and one person just posts a sweater with a dick embroidered on it. And
okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things where everyone's just, there's some jokester in the group, and at some point it starts to do this sort of thing that's closer to what you'd see in Lifeline or a Telltale game, where it's like, okay, you are going to suddenly decide what this group might actually do because you're one of the voices in the group, and they want to have a consensus on things, and you can steer things one way or the other. And there's something really natural about the way everything gets typoed and the cadence and speed of the texts. that feels incredibly natural as someone who lives within a smartphone age myself and has friends that post similar messages to me on Facebook Messenger and all sorts of stuff like that. And it's this really clever weaving of these modern touches with an actual story that I really like.
So, you mentioned Lifeline. Did you play Lifeline?
The iOS one, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I was the one that recommended you Lifeline at some point, which I'm sorry it never worked out for you, but...
Okay. Well, yeah, that was going to be my next question. Sorry, I must have forgotten this. I was going to say, did you like Lifeline? Because if you like Lifeline, then personally I hesitate on your recommendation of this game because I hated Lifeline.
I like the concept. I like the first half of Lifeline. I feel like the second half kind of fell apart a bit. It didn't really know where to go. And
that's definitely true.
Yeah, at some point it doesn't do very interesting updates, and then the ending is really rushed. My current issue with the Mr. Robot game so far is sometimes the interface itself just feels a bit too... I feel like some of these companies are worried that their app will be mistaken for an actual messaging app by someone, and they'll end up getting someone in trouble, because it does certain things like, automatically, it's in the background while you're using it. It's playing this song that sounds very similar to what you'd hear in the backing soundtrack of the show. And that's kind of a... It's a nice song, but at the same time, I'm here to do this specific thing, to be immersed in this adventure that's masquerading as a chat client, and I'd rather not have that. And there's certain things with just the way that text messages, you get notifications for them, and the way that time seems to freeze entirely until you actually open it, except for the part where, well, it's kind of a half freeze because the game is designed to be played over a week, so it has certain timers of you do something and then hours later it will eventually respond. But when you actually open the response, even if you've been asleep or something like that, it still acts like it was sent seconds ago, which is like, no, I'm aware that it got sent hours ago. And it just feels like it's little niggling things like that that make me wish.
Makes you wish that there was another Majestic. You're like, why isn't this the Majestic?
Yeah, I guess I kind of wish it committed to it more. Like, at some point, one of the characters was like, I need you to find more information about this person. And the whole act of eventually kind of pretending to be her HR manager to get enough information to contact the real HR to pose as her, that was a lot of fun, but it was kind of disappointing when I was told to just get information from this person, and there was silence for a while. I couldn't respond to them because it's a game where you can only respond at certain times and with a choice of pre-written messages. So I was kind of like, okay, I have some time. I'll go ahead and look this person up online, and they were not on the actual internet, and that was kind of like just a aw moment.
Okay. Well,
overall, I'd say it's a pretty good time. It's like $3, and if you're already a fan of the show, or you're just interested in seeing something that has its own view and its own portrayal of modern technology, then it's worth a look. And it's also made by the people who did Oxenfree, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, that actually makes me more interested in checking it out, because my main problem with Lifeline was that I thought it was badly written. And I think the people who made Oxenfree know how to write.
So. Yeah. Especially TeenSpeak.
So I'm holding off on the full deep dive into World of Warcraft Legion. I'm going to try and write an article soon. I'm saying this on air to sort of pressure myself to get it done about some of the interesting things that they're doing with lore. And then later this month, in fact, at the very end of the month, when they release the expansion proper, I'll play that and want to talk about that. But right now, I just want to talk about the 7.0 patch that they did. So World of Warcraft, every time when an expansion's about to come out, they push a big patch a little beforehand, which is basically, here are all like the big system level changes we're doing for this expansion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And usually that means there's going to be a revamp of talents, and which are, you know, the talent trees. That's a concept that's in other games, right? You know, like your skill tree, right?
Yeah.
You put points as you gain levels and stuff. So they redo talents, and they sometimes do some revamps of how classes work, generally speaking. And they did a pretty big one for Legion, I would say. And it's interesting also going back to it, because there's a lot of stuff in World of Warcraft's combat that has been that way for such a long time. And it's weird when that stuff changes, and it's also weird when that stuff doesn't. Or when, like, we're at the point now with World of Warcraft where some of it's kind of looping around. So an example of what I'm talking about is, back in the day, hunters were kind of infamous for... The joke term was hunter gear, right? Because the way hunters were built, every single stat was good for them. Because they had armor, and they had a mana bar, so they needed intelligence, and they had, they did agility for their damage, but they also had melee weapons, so they could use strength for damage, and they could also use more HP, so, like, every single stat technically was useful for them. And so you got a bunch of hunters who people very kindly called huntards, who just rolled on every piece of gear and were general jackasses, and eventually Blizzard removed melee weapons from hunters.
Wow.
Because they were like, that's not really what you guys are about. You're a ranged class that has pets, and you shoot with a bow or a gun. And we feel like, you know, it's cool thematically that, like, if something gets in your face, you can do a few swings and push it away. But we feel like it's confusing the vision for the class, right?
Yeah, totally. Having too many melee at once probably makes for a pretty boring game.
And also, like, the hunter's melee abilities weren't... they didn't have very many, right? They had, like, two or three buttons they could hit. And it's just like, no, you just can't do very much at melee. But the fact that they were there made some people feel like they had to use them. Or in the case of some particular friends of mine, made my players use them just to make other people around them angry. I have good friends. So they got rid of that. And now hunters just use weapons, right? And then there are a bunch of people who are saying, like, well, hang on, like, you have a class called... You have one of the specializations for hunters, one of the three specs, is called marksmanship, and it's just about being really good, a really good shot. Why do I have to have a pet? And it's like, well, you can dismiss your pet, but then you're just worse, right? You can send your pet away, and your pet will not fight, and you'll just be shittier. But that's a thing that people have been asking about for a long time. And so they've done a couple of things which are interesting. One is, if you are a marksman hunter, one of the talents you can pick is that you don't have a pet and you deal extra damage.
Huh.
People have been asking about for a long time, and they did it, and it's weird.
Yeah, even with Vanilla WoW, well, I haven't played a ton, but I always saw the hunter pet thing as just the way that character was built.
Totally. Totally. And it's weird that you can just opt out of it. But another thing, and I apologize because I am an on-again, off-again WoW player, and I haven't taken a deep dive on how hunters work in a while, right? So I'm not positive as to how recent all of these changes are. But there's always been a specialization of hunters called survival, right? And they're sort of based around, like, traps and, you know, wiles, right? And Hunter has Marksman, Beastmaster, and Survival. And now if you pick Survival, your gun disappears. and use a melee weapon.
Huh. So not only do they have a hunter version for people who don't want a pet, they have a hunter version for people who want melee.
Mm-hmm. And it's, like, I played some of it, and it's really cool. Like, one of your abilities is called Harpoon, and you just throw a harpoon into a dude and then reel yourself in to them. And that's really fun. And then you can call down a Murder of Crows to attack them. And if they die while the Murder of Crows is over them, then the cooldown on the crows is reset, so you could just throw crows everywhere. Like, it's really, as a person who has genuinely never played Hunter past, like, level 20, because I get bored of them so fast, it's really neat what they're doing with these specializations to make them really feel unique, which is always a thing that I've found to be a problem, right?
Yeah.
Like, I played a lot of Warrior, and I played Fury Warrior, and the specializations of Warrior are Arms, Fury, and Protection. Protection, you use a sword and a shield, and you're a tank. But Fury and Arms are both DPS, and it was always kind of unclear what made them different. And by this point, it's like, well, like, Fury Warriors can dual-wield two-handed weapons. You can use two two-handed battle axes at once. Whereas Arms are more about, like, bleeding effects and precision attacks and control. And it's kind of interesting to see them refine this stuff. It's also interesting because specifically with Warriors, and I'm sorry, I'm ranting about WoW for a long time. Specifically with Warriors, they used to work, I mean, they still work on a mechanic called Rage, but they've completely revamped it. It used to be that everything you did cost Rage, and you got Rage either by dealing or taking damage, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works anymore. Only, like, I have a warrior who is a Fury Warrior at level 95, and currently the cap is 100, it's about to go up to 110. Only two of my abilities use Rage. Most of my abilities don't use anything. They just have a cooldown, and if I use them, they generate Rage, and you no longer get Rage for getting hit or hitting, just for using these abilities. And it's a really huge redesign of how the class works, because part of what made Warriors so hard to balance around in the past is that they were kind of a fair-weather class. Like, if you were getting lots of Rage for whatever reason, then you would get more Rage. It's just sort of, it was a feedback loop. And if you had none, it was really hard to get any. You would get kind of starved.
So is this one of those situations where I might be misunderstanding this. Could you just, while you're walking from area to area in dungeon, just mash on the skills that get you Rage in order to build that up for a fight?
They have to hit something.
Oh, okay.
So, like, you can't do that. But also there wouldn't be much reason to, because, like, the abilities you have that cost Rage are, like, one of them is, like, a flurry of blows that has a long cooldown after you use it. Not crazy long, but decently long. And the other one is the classic ability Execute, which you can only use when a target's below 20% HP anyway. So anyway, they've done a lot of revamps to the classic WoW combat that have been really, really interesting to see. A lot of rethinking of some basic premises to make the classes feel more diverse. And they've been doing some crazy stuff with the lore. And I feel like this is the most seriously they've tried on WoW in quite a few expansion packs. And it's pretty exciting as a person who still love the game, but I just don't have time for an MMO in my life anymore. I feel like I can prioritize better generally, but maybe I'll end up giving a few months to this.
All right. Well, one thing that I was kind of want to ask you is, I know that you're typically a PvE guy, usually like running through dungeons with people or doing stuff on your own, and in the past you haven't been too hot on the PvP side of the combat. Mm-hmm. Do you think that any of the recent changes have made you interested in at least going into that and dabbling a bit?
I mean, the problem for me with MMO PvP is that I feel like it's just fundamentally not going to work out because there are a lot of factors, right? One is MMOs tend to have more latency, so the combat has to be built with that in mind. So it tends to be not as, you know, like, not as built around, like, reflexes and skill, in my opinion, I guess. The other part is that it tends to be very gear-based, so it's like, oh, like, it doesn't matter that you're playing better, you don't have a good enough sword, so you're not going to win the fight. Oof. Which I don't enjoy. And then the last part is just the part where it's such a big game and the combat has to serve so many masters that I just feel like the PvP is never going to be the one, right? Like, playing Destiny, which I played a fair bit of, I felt like the PvP in that wasn't terrible, but, like, the existence of the PvE made the PvP's balance weird, right?
Yeah, basically they tried to somewhat make it so that all the guns felt the same way, but there were clearly guns that had different rates of fire and things like that that weren't affected by their system of balance at all. So as long as you have the quickest gun, it pretty much you could wipe people out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And you know, they've done more work on Destiny's PvP, and I imagine they'll do more yet. But the fundamental problem is that you're creating one set of combat mechanics and values and balance, and you're asking it to do so many different things. And PvP is fundamentally a thing where you have to be really careful, because any loopholes players will exploit. And if they're exploiting them against AI, then who cares? If they're exploiting them against other players, that's not fun. So I don't see a version of WoW PvP that I'm going to care about. It just seems like a bad idea to me.
I see. I think when I was playing Guild Wars a while back, their solution to that was you could just go into this area and they would give you pretty much default weapons for everyone. Like, they made it so that it was closer to a normal shooter in terms of loadout. So you would basically, there would be no skill gap with whatever you were had equipped. Do you think that something like that would make it more fun to do WoW, aside from the, like you mentioned, different style of combat?
I do. Because, like, I used to do a thing in WoW back in the day. I did actually do some PvP. I did what was referred to as twinking, because all the terms for stuff in WoW have to be terrible, right? That's a community term, for the record. All the community terms are just so bad. But twinking is basically, PvP is set up in brackets, right? If you are level 10 to 19, you're in one bracket, 20 to 29, 30 to 39, and then, you know, currently, 90 to 99, and then 100 has its own bracket, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll only be matched with people in your bracket. You can't queue as a level 19 and be matched with someone who's level 35, because obviously they would just destroy you. And twinking was creating a character and intentionally getting them to one of the cutoffs. In my case, it was level 29. And then just stopping there and not progressing anymore and getting them really good gear and then playing just PvP. I had a level 29 paladin twink who was just permanently stuck at level 29, the upper bracket for that, you know, the upper level for that bracket. And I would do the PvP battleground, Arathi Basin, which is like Battlefield's conquest mode, basically. And that was really fun. And part of what made it fun was that your power was pretty limited at that point. Like level 29, like you have some tricks, you have some strong moves, but you aren't crazy bananas. So it's really, I felt like it was pretty fun. But part of what makes twinking fun is that a lot of the people who are going to be in those battlegrounds are people who are leveling, and you just destroy them. So
I see. So it's twinking is something of an archaic term for what I know as smurfing, which is people. Well, it's a bit different because people start new accounts altogether.
Yeah, and smurfing,
there's no way to keep it somewhat steady at this one level.
Mm-hmm. Like smurfing. I think it's certainly conceptually similar, but like, I mean, smurfing is kind of silly in World of Warcraft because everyone has alternate characters, right? It's not like you're not doing a weird thing when you create a second character and play that. Everyone does that.
Yeah, meanwhile, smurfing people end up buying new accounts or paying for... I mean, buying new copies of the game in some cases, or paying for an extra Xbox Live or PlayStation Network subscription.
And you can do that in WoW, but that's a different thing, because there's no reason to do that unless you're going to play with yourself, which is referred to as multi-boxing, where you are playing multiple copies of WoW at the same time with yourself.
Do they have rules against that?
Yes.
I thought
they
so.
They have some significant rules against that. Some people do it anyway. It's so easy. Like, if you care to report these people, it's the easiest thing in the world, right? Because, like, you see this, like, this train run by of four people who are identical, wearing the same outfit, customized the same way, with similar names, running in lockstep, but they're four different classes. And you're like, oh, multiboxer, you're reported. If you care, which often it's like, eh. Like, if they queue for a dungeon, and then they're terrible, like, they're the tank and the healer and the DPS, and you're sort of along for the ride and they're sucking, maybe you'd want to report them then because they're screwing up other people's experiences. But if they're just running around the world, then I don't care, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're not getting in anyone's way.
So, that sounds like they're a bit more obvious than I would expect for someone doing something that's against the rules.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's one of those things where, like, I think... I mean, I can't speak as to how Blizzard treats it, but I imagine if these people are staying out of the way and, like I say, not getting into, like, PvP or PvE, like, dungeon stuff where they're messing with other people's experiences, these people are paying for accounts, they're paying for their months of subscription. If they're not messing with anyone else's experience, who really cares? If they want to give you extra money, I would take it if I were them, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's for the moment, that's it for World of Warcraft. We'll do more, you know, when Legion comes out proper in 11 days or so. 12 or 11 days or something. The 30th. But for the moment, let's talk about some news. I guess we both have a couple of pieces of news. Do you want to go first?
All right. Sure. Let's see. So I guess the big one for me, out of the stuff that I've written down is Final Fantasy XV recently announced. Well, they've had for a while. They've been talking about this limited collector's edition that's like $270, and I think it gets you things like a figure, a nicer case, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those gigantic boxes, if you've seen one of those before.
It's got a copy of Master Chief's helmet, and, and you know, it's got some DLC, and, you know, the season pass, and...
Actually, for $270, the season pass is not included. That is something they came out recently and said that, that's gonna be a separate thing. They said that we've already spent a lot of money into this. This is an expensive thing to produce, and, adding a season pass would just push it over what they're currently charging, they say. So, it's not going to be part of it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, for $270, you'd think that part of that would include a season pass, but I'm not the economist here. I can't say exactly how much of a loss they would take if they added that in, too.
Well, I don't know. I mean, do you have a nose?
Yeah, I have a nose.
Do you have an okay sense of smell?
Sort of. I have trouble smelling things sometimes.
Me too. My nose isn't great. I've sort of... You can ask any of my siblings. My sense of smell is not amazing. But even so, I feel like I can smell some bullshit right now.
Yeah, pretty much. It's really... they're obviously... really grasping at whatever they can get right now.
Yeah.
And after I've heard... It's hard to say exactly whether they really need this many... I forget the exact millions that they say that they need to sell in order to make their money back. But it's that typical Square Enix thing where they were like, oh, we need to sell this many copies of Tomb Raider 1. this number that will never ever be reached, even in the most generous of estimates. So it's hard to tell if they're just really bad with money or if they just keep saying this stuff so they can basically try and guilt people into buying them more.
I mean, I honestly think they're pretty bad with money. I think the way they handled Final Fantasy 13 and its whole rollout was just like, do you understand how development works?
Yeah, that was interesting how they completely threw away that entire game and made a new one within such short amount of time.
And just like, we're so blatant, like kind of like bragging about like, we wasted so much money on all this content we're never going to use. Like, that's not good. That's a bad look, you guys.
Yeah.
Suggest that you have no idea what you're doing. And like, Final Fantasy 15 was a Final Fantasy 13 game. It is part of that same project. And they're still trying to get it out, and they just delayed it because they still can't get it out.
It's their Duke Nukem forever, basically. Like, this project was started 10 years ago, and like you said, it's gone through so many changes. I think that they've also had so many shuffles within the creative team, too. Like, at some point, well, for the longest time, the Kingdom Hearts director was working on 15, but at some point, everyone decided it would be better for him just to start making the new Kingdom Hearts like a bunch of people wanted, so he's working on that now, which probably explains why we've had so many Kingdom Hearts spin-offs and no Kingdom Hearts 3 for this long.
I don't like Square Enix itself, Square Enix proper. They are just such a shit show. They own some talented studios, and that's good, because they're kind of keeping afloat the idiocy that the main studio is up to.
Yeah, Eidos, it seems to be the big moneymaker for them these days, but even then, Tomb Raider didn't make the money back, and
well, Tomb Raider made its money back. They were putting the burden of other failures on Tomb Raider. It's not that Tomb Raider didn't make its budget back, it's that they said, okay, Tomb Raider, you need to make your budget back, and also Final Fantasy XIII's budget. They're putting their failures on Eidos' shoulders.
Yeah, you've got a point there. I hope that they realize where the money's coming from, and they don't see this constant, oh, it's not making these figures, as a sign to then lay off Eidos, because Eidos is doing the most creative work. I imagine that they're the ones mostly behind stuff like Square Enix Collective and the entire Montreal team doing all those fantastic mobile games. I'm not even interested in Deus Ex Mankind Divided, but I am tempted by Deus Ex Go.
Yeah, it's a weird company these days, just because their portfolio is just this weird, like, it's not like they're a company that handles every genre and every type of game. They handle, like, several very specific, extremely different ones, and it's just strange now. Like, oh yeah, no, Final Fantasy and Hitman, that makes sense.
Yeah, and amazingly, it used to, I think even in some of its highest days, Eidos was always seen as something of a mid-tier publisher compared to what Square Enix was at one point. And now it's kind of like not only has it swallowed Eidos is kind of defined its big successes both critically and commercially.
Yeah. It's a weird thing. I don't know. I hope Final Fantasy 15 is good. I'm pretty sure it'll be bad.
Yeah, that reminds me, the movie's out. The movie came out today, so...
Right.
I should probably see that.
Should you?
I'm really curious, like,
You have some weird self-destructive tendencies, my friend.
I've seen all this. I basically own the first Dead Space movie, which is a pile of shit. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the situations where I really like the actors who are in it, like Aaron Paul and that woman from Game of Thrones, the one who plays the Queen. But yeah, I'm a fan of the voice talent, and there's part of me that still really wants to like Final Fantasy 15 and hopes that it's good, so I'm kind of hoping that it'll be something better than both their Spirits Within movie and their Advent Children movie. And maybe that's hoping for too much, but we'll see.
Yes. Advent Children was... When I say it was better than it had any right to be, do not take that as me saying it was good. But I think both of the... I think it was better than it had any right to be. I think it should have been way more of a shit pile than it was, and it wasn't great. This is going to be terrible.
Yeah, it's... Well, the key thing with Advent Children was it was mostly their fan service-y, all those different videos that you've probably seen on YouTube of Flash animators recreating their favorite battles. It was basically that with a big CG budget. And
it looked kind of cool.
Yeah. There were,
that story was dumb. Dialogue was dumb. Character development was dumb. It was all pretty dumb. But he cut stuff real good.
Yeah, and they even brought back Sephiroth somehow for like 5 or 7 minutes. And then...
That part where Sephiroth impaled Cloud on the end of his like 9-foot-long sword and then swung him around a bit, that was okay.
Yeah. And they had, that movie's the reason why in the Final Fantasy VII remake, the dude who plays Jet in Cowboy Bebop is going to be playing Barret, and that's pretty good to me.
The English voice, I assume you mean.
Yeah, the English voice.
Okay. I was like, oh, actually, that would be really... Oh, he means the English voice. Okay.
The English voice for Barret's pretty good. I mean, the English voice for Jet.
Yeah, I'm not criticizing. Just, you know, that's... To me, that's, you know how I am. That's not the voice of Jet to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I have a bit of news myself. Okay. Cities Skylines has announced a new expansion, adding natural disasters.
Oh, boy. That sounds pretty awesome. I kind of have a... Well, I try to stay away from guilty pleasure these days because you shouldn't really feel guilty about things you enjoy, but I'm kind of into those budget-tier disaster games sometimes.
And also, like, I mean, you know, I think we all... Okay, not all of us. Probably. I can never make a statement of I think we all, but I think a great deal of us have fond memories of playing the old SimCity games and getting impatient and being like, fucking, just have a fire start, have a tornado hit, have UFOs attack, just, you know, take a second, break the stress, break the monotony, blow some stuff up.
Yeah, you can enter a cheat and Godzilla would show up, and that's pretty cool.
And this is like a whole expansion of that, so that should be really, you know, I assume it's City Skylines, they'll add other features as well. But, like, you know, for a game that I like but I can't play for too long because it's such a mellow, slow-paced game, that might actually make a big difference to me, you know?
Yeah,
like the ability to sort of cut loose every once in a while.
Yeah, I'm pretty curious about that because I'm assuming it's a paid expansion, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so... Is it something where when you buy it, they're going to give you a cheat menu for some of the crazier ones, and then some of the other ones will just appear either through freak occurrence or you doing something wrong?
I don't know, and I don't think they've talked about that yet. It was just announced the other day.
I see.
So, I think it was one of those Gamescom announcements. So I think news is still a little scant on that one.
But. Yeah. That's an interesting concept to me, making that an expansion, because that was, like you said, typically just something that came in through SimCity, and I'm not saying that it's greedy for them to charge. I'm just curious how that works for something that was normally either something you never see unless you were cheating, or just some of the milder ones just popped up from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're adding a bunch of mechanics around disasters, like, you know, radio broadcasts or evacuations or early warning systems. And then one of the possible disasters that they have announced is called The Day the Sky Exploded, which sounds pretty fantastic.
Amazing.
So, I am curious about that.
Oh, yeah, and I haven't even thought about how this could be tied into mods. I'm sure when that comes out, someone's going to be hard at work at making a Fallout mod or something, or at least some sort of nuclear deterrent setup.
Anyway, so that's the City Skylines news. I think we have time for one other piece of news?
Yeah, do you want to talk about either... Oh, yeah, I guess we could talk about Overwatch a bit. Yeah.
Way to break the facade there.
Oh, sorry.
No more podcast magic.
Okay, take two. I have one more piece of news. Let's talk about what Overwatch added in its most recent patch. Usually patches are kind of dry, but someone on Twitter ended up noticing that there were some weird terms thrown in, like, Mommy tells me that we shouldn't suck our thumbs, and, things like, I'm trying my best to be nice, and it might fail at sometimes, but please give me some space. And people were curious why that was in there. And then someone else noticed, offhandedly, when they type in GG easy, which is usually something that a winning team sends to a losing team if they're basically dicks, it basically replaced that with these random catchphrases that either are overwhelmingly nice or kind of mocking the person who's saying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's, it's just a filter, a substitution filter. So if you type in GG easy, one of these phrases will come out instead, which are either self-deprecating or just friendly. And it is worth noting this patch is currently on the PTR. It is possible these will not be in when this goes live. I hope that's not the case, but, you know, anything on the PTR can be considered, like, a work in progress and not, you know, necessarily representative of the final product.
Do they give people access to the PTR? Like,
Totally.
Is that something I could just switch on?
Mm-hmm. If you go into Battle.net and you're about to launch, you go over to where you would launch Overwatch, there's your region select, and one of the regions is PTR. You will need to download some stuff, but yeah, you can totally do that.
Huh, that's pretty neat. I'll probably stick with vanilla, so I have a completely stable game, but that's kind of neat that you can test that stuff.
I mean, PTR builds don't tend to be unstable. It's just sort of like your progress is temporary, because it's a different, like, any loot chests you get, they're going to be gone as soon as there's a new PTR patch, and they won't go to your live version.
Oh.
So, you know, it's good if you, like, there's a patch and you're like, oh, I'm curious about how this plays, and you want to try it out before it goes live. I've done that numerous times. I don't personally recommend spending extended time on the PTR. I got a drop of a Mercy skin, a legendary Mercy skin that was really dope, and then, you know, it's the PTR, so it was just gone, and I was super bummed.
Oh.
You know, these things happen, but...
Yeah. Speaking of skins, I'm probably going to... I didn't play enough of the summer games, and that's coming up soon, so I'm probably just going to make my first microtransaction purchase and get one of those 50 loot chest things so I can try and get the skins that I really want out of it.
50's a lot. You make your own calls, but you can buy less than 50, and that's... Think about that, is all I'm saying.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And the other problem, like, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea to buy some chests because this event is going to end soon and you want to get a limited time thing. But keep in mind the potential, if you buy too many chests, to sort of break the loop for yourself so that getting chests is no longer satisfying. That's a real danger.
Yeah, maybe a bit less than 50 is a good idea then. I'm not sure what the sweet spot is, but I'll try and figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. With Overwatch stuff, the other things they've added, they've got some new balance changes and things. I might record a podcast soon with someone else talking about some of these things. But suffice it to say, Genji has been a little out of control, and they're nerfing him a bit. And they're buffing Hanzo, which no one in their right mind asked them to do. And I'm wondering if maybe that change won't make it to live, because... I played some on the PTR, and I was facing teams that had four Hanzos. And it's like, well, on the PTR, people feel more free to try out the new thing and don't really care if they're playing well, right?
Yeah.
The thing was, those four Hanzo teams were not just winning, they were steamrolling.
Yeah.
And a four-sniper team should not be winning.
Yeah, in regular pub games, Hanzo already kind of feels like such a force in nature that buffing him would probably be a major turn off for me.
I feel like, I mean, the problem with him, in my opinion, is just that there's not... The way he's built feels a little more... I don't want to say luck-based, but, like, he's a sniper whose arrows do really high damage, and because his arrows have travel time, he's encouraged to fire into doorways where there is no one there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone will walk through and get hit by an arrow fired by a Hanzo who didn't know they were there. And that just doesn't feel satisfying in any way. Like, it feels okay for the Hanzo because he just killed somebody. But if you're on the receiving end, you're like, okay, he didn't know I was there. He didn't aim for me. He didn't do a clever thing. He was just shooting through a doorway. And it's an arrow. It's not like you really hear it coming. It's just, you just randomly are dead. And that sucks.
Yeah. Not to mention that whole double dragon thing that just rips through teams and seems to come around pretty quickly.
That's just you not having played enough Overwatch. That yeah. That ult's not. Like, once you get a little better at the game, like, that ult airballs so much. It's so, like, you hear it and you just run to the side and it misses your entire team and he's wasted his time. You'll get used to it.
Yeah, I guess the people I've been playing with recently are pretty good at getting us into corners and then doing it, and that's a bit harder.
And at that point, then he's earned it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, okay, if you corralled us into a bad position and fired it, then good for you. That was smart play. No, it's, you know, it's the fact that he can just sort of spam his arrow and hope for a lucky hit. And also, I really hate his scatter arrow, because the way his scatter arrow works is that he fires a shot that then splits into 4 or 5, I don't remember exactly, other shots that ricochet around an area.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do with that is you fire it into a small room, and if there's anyone in that small room, then they're dead. They're just screwed. You fire it into a big area, you're probably not even going to hit anyone. But it's just a really weird binary ability where if someone is in a small room, then they're toast. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, well, this doesn't feel like he did anything that smart, and it doesn't feel like I screwed up. I just got killed, and that doesn't feel good.
Yeah, I can see why.
So, anyway, I like Hanzo conceptually. I like a lot of what he does. I love his sonar arrow thing. That thing is great. But Hanzo does actually have some problems right now. He is maybe a little underpowered, at least at a higher skill level. But I don't think the answer is just giving him better hitboxes on his arrows and making him fire faster, because maybe that will make him more viable at a pro level, but it makes him maddening at a lower level, and it doesn't make him more interesting. I think they need to think of some more considered changes rather than just, we'll tweak his numbers. So.
Yeah, I hope that no matter what happens, I hope that D.Va continues to be a more reliable player character to play as, especially against Hanzo.
Yeah, D.Va is pretty good these days. She's pretty fun. And, yeah, they made good changes to her.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that's probably all we got for you. We got a nice long episode for you. We'll try and get another one of these out next week, because this has been fun to try and keep it up at a good clip. And hopefully I'll have played more Professor Layton by then, and you know, we'll have more games to talk about. Hopefully more news as well.
Yeah.
But until then, thank you so much for joining us. You can find this on iTunes, this podcast. It's part of our Scanline Presents feed. If you wanted to give us a rating or review there, you could help drive us up the charts, get more eyes on our podcast, or ears, I guess, is probably the more relevant sense. You could also go to scanlinemedia.com if you wanted to read articles and reviews and watch some videos that we create doing some games critique. And if you wanted to give us a little help, you could go to patreon.com/scanlinemedia and chip in. That money goes towards helping us cover more games. None of it goes into our pockets. It's just, you know, we need a new game or we need a new piece of equipment. We spend it on that. And, yeah, from me here at Scanline, and of course from Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Have a good day.
Peace.